The people to whom this letter was written lived in an ungodly and unbelieving world. They, in fact, had come from paganism themselves. It would not be surprising at all that as they gathered with their family, friends, for whatever reason, they were still pagans. It might challenge their faith. And here in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15, Peter writes, he said, "Sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you." You'll note the word defense, if you're reading the New American Standard Version, has a little number by it, and out in the margin, it will say, or argument, or explanation. The idea is to be able to give an objective, rational reason for why you believe in Jesus, and why you believe that He is Lord and Master of your heart and life. Why do you believe He's your Redeemer? Why is He the one that has caused the moral change that you have experienced and caused you to have the priorities that you now have? He is not telling these people that they have to be ready to give an answer to every philosophical argument that a pagan might make. He's not saying that they have to be ready for every new argument that might arise by disbelievers. There are answers to paganistic arguments. But the right approach, the solid approach, the abiding approach for us as believers is to know why we believe what we do. And as parents trying to ground our children, you will never prepare them for everything they will always hear. They're going to hear arguments in school and college, and there are going to be new ones. But you can prepare them to have a solid faith if they know the objective reasons for why you believe in Jesus. This is important in our approach. Let's suppose, for example, that somebody came to you and said, "The person you call your father is not your father." "Why?" "Well, he's short and you're tall. He's heavy, you're skinny. He has black eyes, you have blue eyes." And they just kept on and on and on. "He likes sports, you don't like sports." And they just keep amassing reason after reason. Would you begin to doubt he's your father? It may be that if you concentrated all your time listening to these kind of things, you might begin to have a question mark in your mind. But if you know why you believe that person is your father, you believe it on the basis of testimony. You believe it on the basis of the testimony of your father, your mother, your brothers, your sisters, your aunts, your uncles, friends who were there when you were born. You may have in your possession a birth certificate, a document. You believe it on the reliability of that document. You may believe it on collateral evidence, in the similarities of conduct, of likes and dislikes physically, food and etc., between you and your father. The point is, you can know who your father is in spite of all of the effort that someone might make to undermine your faith, if you have objective, sound reasons for knowing. The same is true with our faith in Jesus Christ. The devil will never tire trying to undermine our faith and throw all kind of questions at us. This verse says, know why you believe. Be able to explain why you believe. Teach your children to know why you believe. Now, we've been presenting some lessons along that very line. And just like the birth certificate that you believe is reliable, attested at a court of law, you have in your possession four remarkable documents: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Documents that can be shown to be 2,000 years old. Documents that can be shown to be an accurate, your copy is an accurate copy of what was written during that time. It can be shown that the names who are attached to those documents are the authors of those documents. You have in your hand four remarkable documents that testify Jesus is the Son of God. What's in those documents? It's not just a page that says, Mark says, I believe Jesus is the Son of God. It's not that kind of thing. What's in those documents are these kind of things. Those men wrote those documents, like Matthew, maybe within 15 to 30 years of the time Christ died. And he wrote about the people who knew him. Here's what they said. He wrote what his disciples said. He wrote what his enemies said. He wrote what even rulers said. You're on the jury. And here come the witnesses. They're in the documents. You make up your mind. And then, of course, there's Mark and Luke and John. And they also have these witnesses. And so you have the testimony of people who were there. I wasn't there. They were there. They said, here's what I saw. Here's what I heard. Even the enemy didn't deny he worked miracles. They just tried to attribute it to some other power. So there's a strong human testimony to his deity and messiahship. Then there's the undeniable public miracles that are recorded in these books. It's not just one or two. There's about 35 separate miracles that are recorded and hundreds of others that are alluded to. He worked them in the open. He worked them before his enemies. They never could deny that he worked the miracle. They simply, again, tried to attribute it to some other power. Is that true? Are all these people liars? Or are they all frauds? They were there. I wasn't there. Your friend who doesn't believe wasn't there. We're reading about people who were there and said, here's what we saw, here's what we heard. And then there's the prophecies. This man Jesus fulfilled prophecies that were written about a Messiah. He fulfilled every one of them. Some of these prophecies were 1,500 years old. Some 400 years old. But there are many of them. And they had to do with things that were beyond his control as a man. And yet he fulfilled all the prophecies and he challenged his enemies. He said, go read your own book. They'll testify of me. Now you start seeing the cumulative effect of all these evidences. It's not just the testimony. It's not just the miracles. And then you have the prophecies. And then maybe you have the greatest evidence of all. That early in his ministry he began to say, I'm going to be killed. And I'm going to rise again. And he didn't just say, I'm going to rise again. He said, I'm going to rise again 3 days. 3 days. Is it true? There's an easy way to disprove it. Go find the tomb and there's the body. But the body's not there. Although there was a guard. And it was sealed. What happened to the body? And then these guys began to say, we saw him. And they were threatened. Some were killed. They kept their testimony. Did he truly arise from the grave? It's our decision to make, but it's made on the basis of objective evidence that Christ is Lord, that you've enthroned him as your Lord. And that's what we've been looking at in the series of these studies. We've got one more we want to look at tonight. And that is his moral glory. As you're sitting in the, did I say you were sitting in the jury box? I meant you're going to be the jury. I don't mean you're going to be a witness. You're in the jury box. You've got to make a decision. And you're listening to these people testify about this fellow. You're going to hear some really, really far out things about this guy as you listen to these people testify. We talked about having him come to the stand and testify on his own behalf. Over in John chapter 8 and verse 46. John 8:46. Here's what this man says about himself. He says, which of you convicts me of sin? Now, you know, if Jesus was live here today and we actually had a jury trial, and he challenged you and you and you, which of you convicts me of sin? We'd be at a disadvantage. Because we didn't live when he lived. We don't know what he did. And maybe we're not as acquainted with the law he lived under as someone who lived then. This is not a question to you and me. This is a question he asked to the people of his day who hated him, who thought he was a fraud, who had the law in their hands, who knew about his life, who heard his teachings. And he challenged them. Tell me one thing I've ever done contrary to the law of God. Now the word that's translated convict here is an interesting word. He doesn't mean which of you accuses me of sin. They did accuse him. They accused him of breaking the Sabbath law. They accused him of blasphemy. They never could prove he ever broke a single law. And the word convict here is the idea of showing and proving and exposing where a person has violated the law. They couldn't do it. If anybody could have done it, if anybody wanted to do it, they did. You have four books. And look, these guys who wrote these books aren't afraid to say what the other guys said. They said what their enemy said. They said what their family said. The family said, the guy's crazy. So it's not that they're trying to hide something in these documents. There's not one record of these fellows ever being able to convict him of sin. That's quite a claim, isn't it? A fellow comes to you today, just an ordinary person, and says, I've never committed a sin. Sure. You don't even have to know him very well. But yet that's what this fellow claims. He's not the only one that claimed it. Peter said, Peter, who he rebuked, said, get behind me, Satan, said he never committed a sin. John in 1 John 3:5 said he had no sin. Judas, who betrayed him, he said, I betrayed innocent blood. The people who were there, we've never seen him commit a sin. Isn't that amazing? His life was in perfect accord with what he taught. If he taught that more important than the earthly pursuits of food and clothing and shelter, if there was something more important, he demonstrated it in his life. He forsook those things. He had no house to call his own. He had no wealth. He sought the rule of Christ in the hearts of men. If he taught people the most important thing was to love God, that's the way he lived. He said, my will is not to do my will, but the will of him who sent me. I came for one purpose, to serve God. If he taught to love man, that's what he demonstrated in his teaching, in his miracles, in his very death on the cross. There's never been another man to walk the earth like this man, if the testimony of these four documents are true. An amazing individual. Or maybe more than that. You know, when people try to solve a crime today, what do they look for? Motive. What drives a person? Was there insurance money? Was it an act of revenge? Was it seeking power? Was it a power struggle? What was the motive? What would have been the motive for this man to live the life he did and make the choices he did? In John chapter 6 and verse 15, here was a ripe occasion. Thousands were following him. It was at the height of his Galilean ministry. He had just fed 5,000 men plus the others there with a few loaves and fishes. Man, they were so impressed. And in verse 15, it says, they were intending to come and take him by force to make him a king. Is that what he wanted? Is that what he wanted? To be an earthly king? Here was his opportunity. But look what it says. He withdrew again to the mountain by himself alone. The things that drive men today to ascend and fame and power. I've said this before, I'll say it again. A good friend of mine and many of you, D. Bowman, told me that, of course, D. used to work in the music world. And he said musicians will work even if there's no money. They'll do it for fame, for applause. That drives people. Here it is, Jesus. He goes to the mountains. What is it with this man? In Luke chapter 9, verse 57, as they were going along the road, someone said to him, "I'll follow you wherever you go." Jesus said to him, "The foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Look, if this man is who he claims to be, the Son of God, couldn't he buy the nicest house that was possibly could be built by mankind? Live in the most beautiful palace? Don't have a house to call his own. Did he have a chariot? No indication. He did a lot of traveling. He wasn't after what drives men, earthly wealth and possessions. That didn't drive him. And then, of course, the popularity and applause. I want to go back and look at John chapter 6 again. Verse 15 shows he wasn't after power, because when they wanted to make him a king, he went to the mountain. Verse 66, you got all these people following him, and he's preaching this sermon, and man, they do not like what he's saying. They don't understand what he's saying, and they don't like what they think they understand. And so verse 66 says, as a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him anymore. As you read this dialogue in chapter 6, you see the tension increasing. You see these people's consternation. Jesus never backed down. He never changed his message. He wasn't trying to just get followers. And when they left him, he turned to his disciples and asked, "Are you going to go away too?" One of the things about his sinless perfection, you will never see Jesus apologizing, "Oh, I made a mistake." You'll never see Jesus praying, "Father, forgive me for my sins." Never. And he made no mistake here. And he had no apology for what he did. Who is this man anyway? What is driving this man? Could it be what he said? God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. Greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. Could it be really what he said in this very sermon in John 6? "I came down from heaven to give men eternal life." Could it be those motives? We don't like to be challenged. We don't like confrontation, because we oftentimes the reason is we don't know if we're going to be able to answer. And we're often afraid to engage in religious discussion for that very reason. I'm going to tell you what, this man engaged in religious debate with the top-notch people, the most informed, the very best, the ones who were ready with argument, quick in wit, sly in the way they tried to trap him. They never could trip him up. They never could ask him a question he couldn't answer. Look at Matthew 22 for an example. In Matthew chapter 22, in verse 15, the Pharisees went and plotted together how they might trap him in what he said. No, this is a plot. They planned. Maybe they got their heads together. They said, "Look, boy, if we ask him this and this way, we'll get him. We'll get him." And remember, the Pharisees were the fellows who said, "We know the law." They studied the Bible. They didn't practice it, but they studied it. In fact, Jesus says, "What they tell you to do, do." Matthew 23. We're going to trap him. You know, it's one thing to be in a dialogue with another individual at work or in your family, but what if they have a conference first and say, let's figure out our best argument? They tried. And you look down at verse 22. Hearing this, they were amazed, and leaving him, they went away. They couldn't answer him. They couldn't trap him. So the Sadducees and other religious groups said, "We'll give it a shot." That same day, some Sadducees who say there's no resurrection came to Jesus and questioned him. And I tell you what, folks, if the Sadducees had asked you and me that question, or probably any other Jew of that day, you wouldn't have known how to answer it, except to say, here's what the Bible says about the resurrection. Because they presented a real dilemma. A real dilemma. Remember the woman who had seven husbands? And so they say, you believe in the resurrection, right? Yes. In the law, you know that a woman can't have more than one husband, right? Right. So in the resurrection, who's going to get her? What would you answer? Jesus said, there's no marriage in heaven. I take care of that. But that wasn't known before. It didn't work. And so, verse 33, when the crowd heard this, they were astonished at his teaching. Pharisees hadn't given up. They're going to try it again. Verse 34, when the Pharisees heard that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered themselves together. One of them, a lawyer. Don't you love lawyers? A lawyer asked him a question. You know, lawyers can, they're good at trying to find the right question, asked the right way. But it didn't work either. And so finally, verse 41, Jesus turned the tables. Now while the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them a question. And I'll tell you what, they couldn't handle it. They didn't know what to do with it. Verse 46 says, no one was able to answer him a word, nor did anyone dare from that day on to ask him another question. Whatever you think about this guy, you know, you say he's a fraud. He's a smart fraud. And if he is a fraud, it looks like his morals would be so low that you'd certainly catch him in some kind of sin. And certainly he's got to have a motive. Some motive. Well, what's the motive if he's a fraud? Not power, wealth, or popularity. What is it? Over in John chapter 2. John wrote, remember, I wasn't there. I'm telling you, a guy who wrote this, who was a beloved friend of this man Jesus, who spent about 3 years with him, following him around, hearing his teaching, and seeing how he treated people. Here's what he wrote. He said, verse 24, Jesus on his part was not entrusting himself to them, for he knew all men. And because he did not need anyone to testify concerning man, for he himself knew what was in man. John didn't write this at this time when this happened. Maybe John, when he wrote this letter later, he was writing, of course, with all of the events of those 3 years, when they'd sit together in a room and Jesus would know exactly what they're thinking and answer not just what they asked, but their thoughts. And he'd know their motives and he'd know each one and their particular peculiar disposition. John said, I tell you about this fellow, he didn't have to ask anybody. He knew what you were thinking. He knew what person you were. And he knew how to respond to you. Matthew 5. You know what Matthew 5 is, don't you? You know, in Matthew 4 and 23, you have somewhat of an introduction to Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Jesus was going throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom. It's interesting if you've ever been to a debate between two, say, preachers. One of the things that sometimes they will do is go back and research a guy's writings of the past. If you've got audios of his sermon, they'll listen to those sermons. So here comes the debate. And they say, here's what you said, or here's what you wrote. Here you have three chapters, Matthew 5, 6, 7, of a sermon Jesus preached. It captivates the imagination. It's the highest moral code ever known to mankind. A marvelous sermon, the depth of which had never been fully fathomed. Who is this man that could teach this way? Surely, would a fraud, just another human, be able to teach this kind of message and teach it with the authority so much at the end of the sermon the people were amazed at how he taught with authority? Well, when you look at the moral glory of this man, as it's portrayed in these four documents, it goes along with everything else we've studied. And it certainly goes along with what John wrote in John chapter 1 and verse 14. This is the introduction to John's account about Jesus. The first 18 verses are. And he starts with the marvelous statement that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then verse 14, he said, the Word became flesh. God became flesh? Yes. The Creator God? Yes, he said in verse 2. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through Him. He's the Creator God. He became flesh? Yes. That's what it says in verse 14. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. That's not us, you and me. That's these men. He dwelt among us, and we, not you, not me, we saw His glory. We're talking about the moral glory of Jesus. There's His moral glory. There's the glory of His nature, His deity. They saw that. And John said, glory as of the only begotten of the Father. Only begotten was a term that meant unique. The Jews considered themselves sons of God, and they were. Even Adam was a son of God. But he's saying this person had a relationship to God like no other being. He's the only begotten Son of God. Never, ever has there ever been a being that lived like this man in his relationship to God. Full of grace and truth. Meaning, if I understand it, full of true grace. You want to understand God and His grace and mercy? Study Jesus. You want to know how God loves man? Study Jesus. You want to know how God feels about sinners? Study Jesus. That's what John was saying. In verse 18, he said, no one has seen God at any time. The only begotten God, or the only begotten Son of God, as some versions translate it. The only begotten God who is in the bosom of the Father. He has explained Him. That's what they believed. And that's why they wrote what they wrote. That's why John said these are written that you might believe. John chapter 20, verse 30 and 31. You know, someone may say, yeah, but you want to believe in Jesus. I do. And you know what? I want to believe that the person I call my mother and my father were my mother and my father. I'm not ashamed at all to say that. But I'll tell you what, that does not change the objective evidence at all. I suspect if we knew this man like his disciples knew this man, we would too want to believe. And if we study these four Gospels, it may be that we'll want to believe in this man because he displayed the love of God, because he displayed and made possible the forgiveness of our sins by sacrificing himself. Because of the example of his life, you could trust him implicitly. He would never let you down. Because of the moral and spiritual code that he gave that transforms lives, and because he gave men hope, he gave women who were condemned by their society as sinners hope. He gave a woman caught in the act of adultery hope. And he gives me hope. Yes, I want to believe in Him. But That's not the reason for believing in him. I believe in Jesus because of the evidence. And that's what we looked at in 1 Peter 3 where we began our study. In Mark chapter 16, well, let me start Mark 1:1. How does Mark begin his gospel? You pick it up, you start to read it. It said, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And then he tells the story. Here are the evidences. And then he gets to the end of that. And he has this man, Jesus, talking to his apostles and saying, go preach the gospel to all creation. He who has believed, what? This gospel. This gospel Mark wrote. This story, this good news about Jesus. He has believed and has been baptized and was saved. And that last phrase, folks, is why everything we've been studying is vastly more important than anything else you might possibly believe or not believe. You could be mistaken about your mother and daddy and live, and it wouldn't affect your eternal destiny. But if what this man says is true, if you do not believe the gospel of Jesus, you are condemned eternally. That's how important it is. There's no school, there's no college, there's no job your children will ever have, ever go to. That's more important than believing the gospel of Jesus Christ. He who has believed and has been baptized shall be saved. But he who has disbelieved shall be condemned. And so we're going to sing the song that Jeff has selected as a song of encouragement and invitation.